forth that I got from the Orange County Crime Lab, who incidentally, Jack,
same guy.
Yeah, Jack, he had a DR, and he could keep that thing working when others gave up. But so I ran all kinds of drug samples, and we published application data sheets showing, you know, the use of the DR in determining heroin and cocaine and things like that. Published the curves. Did the same thing later on for the DK. The DK had a it was the only instrument that would go into the near infrared, and so the near infrared is a very useful instrument, a very useful region of the spectrum to work in. And right now there are all kinds of people that are working in near infrared, but at that time nobody was working in the near infrared. Wilbur Kay had published a paper showing all the chemical groups that would absorb in the near infrared, but it was just a technical paper that showed that you could see OH and CH and things in the near infrared. But so what I did is I went in the to the lab, and any organic liquid that I could find, I ran it throughout the whole near infrared region, and I published several hundred curves, which we had printed up and made available to people. But I had one of our DK customers who had Anderson Laboratories in somewhere in Illinois. Champaign, Illinois, I think, maybe. They had a DK, and he came to me and said, you know, I would like to do what you're doing. He said, and as a business, Sattler Laboratories in Philadelphia had published infrared spectra for just hundred thousands of different compounds, and so I was trying to develop, you know, as many curves as I could get my hands on. But Anderson came to me and said, look, I'd like to continue what you're doing, but to sell the curves later. And so he asked me if I would back off and let him take up the job. So he put a man on it full time and published quite a few, but he never got much of a sale from them because nobody was working in the near infrared. Mm-hmm. And so it was a great idea, but it was ahead of its time. And I was doing it to kind of publicize the fact that here's all these things that you can see in the near infrared. Why not use it? But we were ahead of time. 15 years later, somebody else discovered near infrared, and now it's a big thing. They build special instruments to work in that region. Yeah. And
for the 10 years that you were working in the applications group, did that organizationally, did it remain within sales and marketing?
Yes.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Do you think that was a good place for it to be, or what are your thoughts about that?
Well, it was a good place to be because the money was available to operate it. The sales department. It was a useful sales tool. And in fact, in 1959, it was decided that this was a good idea, and we need to get closer to the customers. So they came to me and said, would you consider moving to Chicago and set up an applications laboratory in the Chicago office? Hmm. We just had a brand new building in Chicago, Lincolnwood, Illinois. And so I said, yeah, I'll do it if you give me a little financial incentive to do it, you know. And I said, I said, I hate to leave California, but I said, would you let me just do it for 3 years? I promise I'll go to 3 years, and if the family can take Chicago for 3 years, maybe we'll stay longer. So I went to Chicago and opened up a field application lab. And then shortly thereafter, we opened up one in the Mountainside, New Jersey office for the eastern region, and ultimately we had one down in Houston in the southern region. And so we had three field application laboratories, in that job, what I did is I worked on customers' samples that the salesman would bring in. But I also did lots of I went out and made sales calls with the salesman, mm-hmm. and we discussed the problems that customers had in their laboratories, and so I did that for 3 years, and then that was when they came to me and said, we'd like to have you come back to California as product line manager for Ultraviolet. So I left. I really enjoyed the work in Chicago, and I would have stayed there longer, but my family, they got my daughters learned to ice skate, and they liked the snow and so forth.
And that, so you established the field
application laboratories
in Chicago. Did you help set up the ones in those other locations that you mentioned?
Well, the plans that I had drawn up for the Chicago office, the layout of the laboratory and so forth, we used those same plans for the other labs. Particularly the one down in Houston was almost identical to the one I had in Chicago. And adjacent to the laboratory, we had a little theater, a little room where we could bring people in and have seminars and things like that, a seminar room, I guess you could call it. And also in that seminar room, we had laboratory facilities. We had lab benches, and we could put instruments up and demonstrate them in there and so forth. So it worked out real well. After I left, Bob Jarnatowski took over, and he was there for several years. And then Leo Clowerty went in the one in New York, New Jersey. So that was how I kind of got away from things for a while.
But then you returned.
Then I came back as product line manager. And
now what, you say you left here in 68?
59.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But then you came back as product.
63, right. I came back as product manager in 63.
And how long did you stay?
As product manager?
Yeah, as product manager and with Beckman.
Well, I was with Beckman until 1986.
Okay.
And incidentally, later on, I went back out field lab. I was the applications chemist for the Western region for a number of years.
For God's sakes. See, after you, I guess after you left product line managership, and I went off into clinical, then
yeah.
we didn't have much contact.
Yeah. Job of product line manager. I'm a technical guy. I enjoy chemistry and spectroscopy and things like that. And as product line manager, I was spending all my time on the telephone answering customer complaints and so forth. The windows are falling off of my UV cells that I bought from you, the $100 cells, and I buy them and the windows fall off.
Did we have a lot of quality problems?
And we had some problems with the UV cells. The DU power supply, have you heard of, did anybody mention the problems with the DU power supply? That, the salesman, you know, for years afterwards, would go in and say to the customer, I'm from Beckman, they say, oh, don't talk to me, I have a DU power supply. The DU power supply, it worked, but it had problems. They would break down frequently, and the other thing was they got very, very hot. People used to put their coffee pot on the top of the DU power supply to keep their coffee hot. It just ran very, very hot. I had, you know, spent many, many, many hours talking to customers trying to calm them down about their DU power supplies. And so I got tired of that, and I got back into the lab again, and enjoyed the lab work. When I was in Chicago, a fellow at Argonne Laboratories, Argonne National Labs, there near Chicago, an infrared spectroscopist. He came to me and
this is Joe Ferrara.
John Ferrara.
John Ferrara.
John Ferrara. He said, "We ought to educate." He said, "People don't know anything about infrared. Let's offer a short course in infrared here in the Chicago area." So I said, that's a good idea, and I said, we can use our little room here to, and invite people to come in, and so we set it up. Actually, I had some experience doing that before, but so we John Ferrara, I think he was the president of the Spectroscopy Society in Chicago at the time, and so he sent out invitations to the members of that society, and then also to the American Chemical Society members in the Chicago area, and so we had about 100 people who signed up, and we charged, I'm not sure, $40 or $50 or something for a series of lectures on infrared. And we found that by charging, you get, if people had committed money, they would come.
Right.
You know, but if it was just a strictly a voluntary thing, they would start and then they'd drop out. But by charging, we got them to come. And so we had, I think 100 people approximately that came for this infrared series. It went on for 6 months or so, once a week. And I had John Ferrara did some of the lecturing, and I did some of the lecturing, and a guy named Joe something or other from one of the oil companies did some lectures. There were three of us that did all the lectures on infrared. We taught them as much as we could about infrared in 6 months. And then we had Beckman instruments there for them to try out
right.
and use and so forth. And so that was very successful. But I say, I knew that that kind of thing would work because when I was here, before I went to Chicago, I was a member of the, we got a spectroscopy society organized here, this Society for Applied Spectroscopy, the Southern California Society for Applied Spectroscopy. Which then we got together with other spectroscopy societies around the country and formed a national society.
Hmm.
And but here locally, we were having trouble getting members. So we decided to offer a series of lectures on spectroscopy. And I was the president of the local society, and so I got to organize this course. And I don't know how many separate sessions we had, but it must have been about 15 or 20. But there would be one session on infrared spectroscopy, one on ultraviolet spectroscopy, one on emission spectroscopy, and then X-ray spectroscopy,
mm-hmm.
and things like that. We went through the whole gamut of spectroscopy lectures, and the lecturers were people who had a name in the society this area of spectroscopy. And we held we had them in a lecture room at Caltech.
Hmm.
And one of the one of our lecturers, a guy, the infrared spectroscopist, X-ray spectroscopist, worked for Caltech, and so he got permission from Caltech to set it up. And so we would have lectures, one lecture a week. We charged, as I recall again, $40 to get the people to come, and it was very, very successful. Plus, as an incentive, the members of the Society for Applied Spectroscopists got half price on this mm-hmm. lecture series.
So you got members.
So if you join the society, you're 40. It cost members paid $20. Non-members paid $40. But if you paid $40, you got membership in the Society for Applied Spectroscopy along with it. So we got a whole bunch of new members for the society that way. So the society was real happy, and we got a lot of interest in spectroscopy here locally, and people really enjoyed the course. It was good. Wilbur Kay did ultraviolet. Who else did? In every case, I had guys from MIT, from University of Illinois, and so forth, professors who came out and gave their lectures on their subjects, and surprisingly, I invited them to come, but I didn't offer to pay them anything for coming, pay any of their expenses or anything, and they came. So that was a very successful thing. But it what it was, it showed me that people are interested in learning. In order to get them to come regularly, they have to pay. If it's free, they won't come regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And
psychology.
Yeah, so that was good. So we charged there in Chicago for our infrared course, and then later on, we got people here at Beckman interested in teaching various aspects of instrumentation to potential customers, and we set up the Technical Education Center, I think we called it. You remember that? Ken Stein was the head of the Technical Education Center, and we had people from Beckman employees who were specialists in the different instrumentation areas, who were in the Technical Education Center, and we went around the country and gave courses in we would go to Miami and be there for 3 days, and we would have 4-hour lectures on different things, and we charged people to come, and people would pay to come. Then we had clinical Dale Harms was there, and he handled clinical. We had electroencephalography and infrared and ultraviolet and things like that. One-day courses, short courses in these various areas, and we did that all around the country. And we would have a building over here by the Fullerton Airport that we would bring people in for these lectures.
So
I did a lot of that.
You got back to having a good time, is what you're telling me.
Yeah. And I taught the various aspects of infrared in various places around the country. The instrument, well, primarily Perkin Elmer and Beckman and Carey, we would contribute instruments and lecturers to different places. For 20-some years, I went every summer, the third week of July, I went over to Tempe, Arizona, to Arizona State University, and spent a week lecturing on infrared. And Howard Sloan and I and a guy from Perkin Elmer were the lecturers. So we did that at Arizona State University. We did summer courses at Fisk University, at MIT, at Canisius College, University of Minnesota, UCLA.
Cover the field.
A lot of that. Again, these were the sponsor was the university that was putting it on, but people from the three instrument companies that were doing all the work and providing the instruments that would be used in the course and so forth. And they were typically a one week long course.
Was there one person in particular who organized these summer courses? Because it sounds kind of unusual to me that you would have, you know, representatives of of three competing instrument companies together repeatedly
the word, teaching. Word got out around, it was primarily through infrared. Like MIT was interested in teaching people about infrared, and so they would when you know at the Pittsburgh conference they'd get together with us and talk about maybe doing things like this, and so it got so that we did it. I don't know. I think the first one was at MIT, and so then other University of Minnesota they found out about it, and so they invited us to do it, and then UCLA and other places, Fisk University. They wanted to do that. Fisk University, they also had a an infrared and a gas chromatography summer courses, and that the instrument companies would participate in.
When did those start, the summer courses?
In the 60s. Some of it was, first one I went to at MIT was while I was in Chicago. The one at Arizona State, I dropped out when I retired. They didn't pay the lecturers. They gave us a nominal sum, a $100 check or something like that for a week of hard work. But primarily that Beckman would underwrite my going there and provide the instruments and stuff for it. And so the same way with Cary and Burke and Elmer.
What was the benefit to the companies? Potential sales?
Sales, yeah.
Real visibility, customers who were interested.
You see, especially in infrared, and some of these other things that came along, the chemists out there in the laboratory didn't learn this stuff in college. It wasn't available to them when they're in school. So they're in lab and they have these problems. They hear somebody in another lab like theirs and says, hey, I got this infrared instrument and it solves all kinds of problems for me, you know. So, but I don't know anything about infrared, so how can I afford to buy a $15,000 or $20,000 instrument if I don't know how to use it?
Yeah.
So this one in Arizona State, it went for, it must have been pretty near 30 years that it operated. One professor at Arizona State was the one who would set the program up. And he had a week on infrared and a week on emission spectroscopy. Beckman didn't participate in the emission thing, but he got other manufacturers come in and help on that. And,
shift gears just one moment.
Sure.
I had one last question, I think, on the application side in that period from 53 to 63. Which was, we heard about the flow of information, you know, the salespeople get information or requests from the customers and brought it to you and then back out. Was there, did the applications group have any role in developing new products, saying, you know, we're using these instruments all the time and we think from what we're hearing from the outside and our use, you know, were you in there, helping to design the next?
Yeah, we would attend the meetings like the Pittsburgh Conference and American Chemical Society meetings, and see what's going on in the universities and so forth. He listened to the papers and talked to the people there, and we would always come back loaded with ideas. Boy, you know, this guy over here at MIT is doing this, and it looks like there's a chance there that we might have an instrument, you know, that would be able to do it. But to give you an example, Hank Nobles was the head of the application engineering after Al Schreiber. And Hank Nobles went to Pittsburgh this 1 year and got talking to a fellow that he formerly worked with somewhere back there. And the guy had developed a little micro balance using a meter movement as the device. What you would do is you have a meter with a needle on it, and you put a weight on the needle, and the needle will go down. Then by dialing in a little current, you can bring the needle back up.
Was that Kahn?
That's Kahn. Well, Hank Nobles came to Beckman from the Pittsburgh Conference and said, hey, that thing looks like it's working well. We need to measure very small quantities for lots of different kinds of samples. And so he said, I think we ought to look into that. So he talked to the engineers, and they seemed to think that was a good idea. Lee Kahn